Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Dr. Amy Robbins, and welcome to Life, Death, and the Space Between podcast. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and medium, and here we explore life, death, consciousness, and what it all means. And today we are going to be digging into love. Humble the poet, Kanwar Singh, is a Canadian-born rapper, spoken word artist, poet, international best-selling author, and former elementary school teacher. What began as reciting spoken word poetry in coffee shops to impress girls evolved into a creative adventure that has spanned the last 10 years, crossing genres, mediums, and oceans. His first two releases, Unlearn and Things Nobody Can Teach Us, have become international bestsellers. His new book, How to Be Loved, is out now. Welcome, Humble.
Thank you so much for having me.
I could really, really use your help. If you haven't had a chance yet to listen to my season 5 opener, go back and listen to that. But in the event that you don't, I need your support. If you've been listening to me for a while, or even if you just started, you can go to Patreon and put in Dr. Amy Robbins, and there you can find different levels in which you can support the podcast financially. At this point, I have no ads. I have no sponsors. I am solely self-funding this podcast, and it would really, really help me out if you've gotten something out of this podcast, if you could donate $5, $10, or even $20 a month just to help me out, to help support the podcast. I'm continuing to work to try to get sponsors, to try to get advertisers, but until that happens, I need your help. And there are other ways to support the podcast. In addition to Patreon, you can like the podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast, you can rate and review the podcast. I always love reading your reviews. They're really heartwarming to me, and it's the emotional currency that I get from providing you with this resource. So please, please take a moment to just help me out here. You can also find the links in this episode, in the episode notes, as well as on my website at dramyrobbins.com. And don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Dr. Amy Robbins. Is that the way we say it? How to be loved? Because I think it's the entree into the conversation that I want to have today.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think people are looking for more love in their life. So, you know, it's kind of, I was trying to kind of play with the title. So, you know, it's how to be loved. But, you know, we put the D in parenthesis because the kind of spoiler alert is to be loved is to be love.
Yeah. So let's start there. This realization for me personally has just crystallized so clearly in recent weeks. But when did you discover that you were love, that you are love?
I think after a failed relationship, I was engaged and we didn't take it to the next chapter. I think at that point, I took a deep dive to kind of figure out why. I think it was clear in that situation that it wasn't a, I wasn't with a bad person. I was with an amazing person, but there was something on my end that was denying me the ability to receive, kind of receive the love that was kind of given to me by that other person. And also realizing that that love, I had love in my family, I had love amongst my friends, but it kind of felt like I was closed off to all of it. And I was really trying to figure that out. And as I took that deeper dive, I started realizing that it wasn't about receiving or giving love. It was really about creating these pathways for love to flow. So, and the love was kind of a constant and always there. But if we have a bunch of junk and debris clogging up these pathways, then you know, we'll never receive that love. And then we'll think we can't find it. So for me, you know, it's starting to realize that love is the breeze and the work is opening the sail more so than it is to find that breeze. Mm-hmm. And I think once that happened, I realized that I myself was a source of that love. You know, I contributed to that flow of love and the work that I had to do with other people, with myself, and with any activity or anything I wanted to do in my life was to, you know, establish that pathway, keep that pathway clear, reinforce that pathway, and understand with some people, places, things, and myself, it could be easier than with others.
And how did you begin to do that? I think you're talking about this moment that so many people have where they're sort of searching outside of their themselves. And then it sounds like you were brought to your knees in a way by this failed relationship. And how did you begin to search for the love within you? Because I think so many people would just go looking for that with someone else again and make the mistake of perhaps not finding it again, because like you said, it's within us.
Yeah, I think what I quickly realized is, you know, especially as a guy who's in a long-term relationship, you know, the moment you become single, you're like, yeah, I'm single. And then you overcorrect the other way. And then you start to realize, you know, the attention, the affection, the sex, the whatever you begin chasing as a single person, all of these are like facsimiles of love. Like they're still related to love in some capacity. And every so often you're given these kind of harsh reminders that this isn't love. You know, the moment, you know, you're at a nightclub and you meet a pretty girl and you're chatting or whatever, and even if you become intimate with that person, you know, there's going to be a moment where they remind you that, look, you're not my person. Like, this was fun, but like, you're not a priority in my life. And then you start missing being a priority in somebody's life, for example. So I think the first thing I realized is my desire and my thirst were actually still for love, but there's just so many kind of facsimiles that we think are love. We think attention and affection and power and control and success and admiration and status and all of these things were love, but they're not. And I think at that point, the next thing I started to look at was this idea of finding love. And then realizing that there isn't finding love. It's just realizing and being open to the love that's there, you know, and realizing that it really was, it wasn't about doing or being something to find this love. It was about, you know, clearing the pathway. It was about letting go. You know, letting go of insecurities, letting go of old habits and beliefs. And that had to start inwards. And, you know, defining self-love, realizing that that is a lot more pragmatic than I thought. You know, people say, love yourself. I love myself. But what is loving yourself? And it's literally treating yourself the way you treat people you love. Because we don't. And often we don't do it because we believe we don't deserve love. Or we don't, you know, we feel like we know ourselves best and we know our imperfections, we know our insecurities, and we feel like all of these things disqualify us from love. Not remembering that everybody that we love right now has insecurities and imperfections, and none of that disqualifies them from love, because there is no qualifications for love. There's nothing that you need to do or be or accomplish for love to be in your life. And then you started to realize like, okay, so a lot of these ideas, why do I have these ideas? Why do I feel like I need it? Well, you may have to look a certain way or be a certain way to get a date or get a phone number or get a job. And a lot of these things, you know, but these aren't love, you know? And I think, you know, and then we also live in a society that needs to sell us stuff. And the way to sell somebody something is to make them think they need it. So, you know, we need these makeup products. We need these expensive suits. You need this $10,000 watch. You need this, you know, extravagant sports car. And what it's going to do is it's going to create a life for you where you're going to be desirable to other people, or you're going to be respected by other people. And all of this is just external. Mm-hmm. So then I started to realize, like, okay, well, I know people who have all this stuff, and I got the friends with the low body fat and the abs, and I got the friends with the nice watches and the nice cars and fly the private jets. And they, you know, they tend to be in the exact same space that I am in terms of mental health and mm-hmm. overall happiness. And they have a couple of cool, other cool experiences, but in general, like we're all kind of in the same boat. Mm-hmm. And then really realizing that, okay, you know, the solution to this internal yearning is going to be internal as well. And that's what helped me realize that, you know, self-love is really this journey of prioritizing your self-respect over your self-esteem. How you feel about yourself is dramatically more important than how anybody else feels about you. And often the better you feel about yourself, the better those others will feel about you as well, whether that's a priority or not. So that journey really had me going down and being like, okay, well, how do I love myself? And learning
that. What did that journey look like for you? Like, did it include therapy? Did it include meditation? I think people often want to know how you found that place of love and acceptance for yourself. And I think as you're talking too, I'm thinking about, what if someone who's listening is actively abusing someone else, whether emotionally or physically, and it's this moment of, holy cow, I the people that I love, I actually don't treat the way I should. I know I've just dumped a lot on right here.
But. Oh, no, not at all. I think it's amazing. And I think, and I like that you framed it from the position of being abusive versus being abused, because I think oftentimes we don't take ownership when we're making the toxic choices in some of our relationships. Mm-hmm. The way we treat others is always a reflection of how we feel about ourselves. And again, so that's going to start internally. So, I mean, from a pragmatic, you know, like actual practical tips on how people can actually love themselves, I think the first thing you have to realize is, in any relationship with yourself or with other people, vulnerability is that first step to build a bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, if I want a deeper relationship with you, I have to be vulnerable with you. I have to recognize that vulnerability isn't 0 or 100. There's different levels to vulnerability. You know, I don't have to tell you my deepest, darkest secrets the first time we meet, but I can be vulnerable with you. I can talk mm-hmm. to you about the first time I lost my dog and how that made me feel, and how mm-hmm. I hesitated to get another dog, you know, mm-hmm. until 10 years later. And, you know, the different emotions that come with that. That's something I could tell a stranger the first time I meet them, and right. not worry about it being TMI or scaring them away. You know, that's the first step to establishing a relationship with somebody, is be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. That vulnerability also exists inwards. You know,
right. So I was going to say, it translates to ourselves too.
It definitely does. So that vulnerability, you know, one of the simplest ways is through journaling. You know, I think self-awareness is definitely our salvation. So for me, therapy, I think, is essential. Any form of therapy. So, and I remember speaking to my therapist about it, because therapists are expensive, and yes, saying, you know,
we are.
What's, yeah. So the question, you know, and as somebody who grew up, you know, my dad was a cab driver, you know, and single income family. And, you know, I have a super big soft spot in my heart for the working class and accessibility. So speaking to my therapist about it, being like, well, what if somebody can't afford therapy? What is the best option? And she said, religiously journaling every single day is the closest thing you can do. You know, therapy is about observing yourself. It's about picking up on your patterns. It's about getting out of black and white thinking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, dumping everything out of your head onto a page and observing it, you know, talking about an event that got you charged up, writing about it, then writing about your emotions around that event, then writing about your thoughts around those emotions. It's really about observing yourself mm-hmm. and realizing that you aren't the thoughts, you aren't the emotions, you aren't
right.
the events.
You aren't your ego, right? I mean, that's ego, what you're yeah. doing, is you're stepping out of the egoic mind. And by watching those thoughts, by observing those thoughts as they're written on the page, you're observing that they are not you.
Yeah. And it becomes very clear how many of us, or all of us, to various degrees are floating through life kind of unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're almost like pinballs, just kind of bouncing around and being extremely reactive to kind of the outside world that we have. So a great way of establishing that vulnerability with self and getting to know ourselves on a deeper level is journaling. Another one I feel is extremely important is irrespective. And again, even with the journaling, you have to protect that journal. Like, you have to be able to freely write in that journal in such a manner that you're never afraid that it'll ever get discovered. Because I think it can get performative.
Here's mine right here. I was journaling earlier today.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
Amazing.
And I'm not a lover of journaling, but I've been trying to dump some thoughts. So.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And it is amazing because I feel like sometimes as life gets busy, I don't make time for journaling, but then I start to feel like I've hit my limit. I'm full and I need to dump it out. And in the moment I start journaling, I'm like, oh, that wasn't as much as I thought. You know, it feels way more heavy inside.
It totally does. It totally does. And like, I'm like, wait, that's all I had? It like seemed like a lot when it was in my head. Yeah. But it's only one page.
Yeah, it's one page, but it felt like 10,000 pounds on my brain.
Right.
And I hope people recognize that's the therapeutic value of it. Hence, you know, the word therapy. And, you know, and speaking to a licensed therapist, it's dumping it out to somebody who's, you know, has additional tools and insights to help you kind of process that information and mm-hmm. can, you know, lightly nudge you in certain directions with their questioning and with them picking up on the frames. And I think that's important. Another one I think is extremely important is irrespective of your religious beliefs, prayer. And what I realized the beauty of prayer is a great way to be authentic about what you actually want from life mm-hmm. and to be authentic about what you're actually grateful for. So if you do, you know, traditional leaning over your bed, put your hands together prayer and say, you know, dear God, dear almighty algorithm, dear, you know, whoever
algorithm. Yeah.
Yeah. Whoever you.
Dear
Alexa, whoever, you know, when you say thank you for and see what comes out of your mouth, what you're mm-hmm. actually grateful for, instead of just kind of being performative and being like, thank you for the oxygen I get to breathe. Like, it may be like, you know, thank you for that extra $10,000 in my bank account that allowed me to take this trip to Hawaii and meet my future partner. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. And I think the expression of gratitude will allow you to become more aware of what actually matters to you. And I think that's important. And then also when you ask for things, it'll also help you realize what actually matters to you. Because you start to realize that what you actually want out of life may be different from other people. And I think that's really important. So journaling, prayer, I think.
Do you find that prayer? Oh, hang on, because I want to hear about dancing. But do you? Because I love to dance. Do you think that prayer has to be a formal experience? Because sometimes for me, I find like I can just, or gratitude, like that could just be something throughout the day where I'm just noticing and being grateful, or asking and thinking, you know, sort of, it's not necessarily a process where I sit down and say, I am so grateful for, but that as it comes, I notice and appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, I believe that anytime that we're like really happy is what we're actually doing is expressing gratitude. You know, somebody takes you to the top of the Eiffel Tower, and then you see the view and you're like, wow, this is amazing. You're expressing gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it was your 15th time up there, you know, that gratitude won't be there because, you know, it's not going to be as magical as it was the first time. So I think, you know, that's what I realize is throughout the day when we have those moments of gratitude, you know, they're more reactionary to life and they're less intentional. Whereas if we sit there and decide, well, what am I actually grateful for? I think it also allows us to kind of get those drops of dopamine and as well as kind of relive those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, so when somebody says, what was the highlight of your 2022? Now you have to go back and think about it and then you get to relive it. And just reliving it is almost re-experiencing it. And, you know, that you kind of flooded with that gratitude. So I think the way I look at it is just intentionally creating more moments to feel great mm-hmm. and feel good. And also build a deeper level of self-awareness. If you start to pick up on patterns where you're like, mm-hmm. Okay. Like, you know, these are the things that actually matter. And I was just thinking about a friend of mine, you know, who's, when we were talking about like what he was looking for in a partner, he had a really interesting answer where he's like, look, I'll date somebody and he's a successful entrepreneur. And he's like, you know, they think the best way to contribute to my life is, you know, maybe cleaning up the apartment or like cooking me a nice meal. And he's like, these actually aren't things that matter to me as much as if I have to delay a plan, if I have to cancel a plan last minute because work got in the way, for them not to make me feel guilty. He goes, I'd rather them be okay with a 9:30 plan moving to 10:30 and not making me feel bad than them ever cooking me a meal. And I think that's, you know, that's him going through his journey, figuring out what matters to him.
Well, and then I think being able to express that is the vulnerability piece, right?
Yes.
That we're all so scared of. Like, if I say this out loud, am I not going to get love?
Yes. And that goes to that. That also goes to this idea where we mix up being loved and liked. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're definitely internally wired to chase acceptance, because I think that was a survival tactic, especially when we were in smaller communities.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of being rejected, the idea of not being liked, you know, for thousands and thousands of years actually meant death. You know, it meant ostracism. It meant you're on your own. So those, you know, we self-corrected and made ourselves likable and understood. And, you know, we're almost people pleasers back then. Now, it's, you know, being rejected, being left out, none of this leads to our physical death.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it just kind of sucks. It's FOMO, it's whatever.
Right.
And I think it's just building that awareness of like, okay, well, now we overcorrect to be likable. We're actually denying ourselves opportunities of love because what we're not doing, because now most likely what we're doing to be likable is we're reducing our boundaries. You know, we're not showing our teeth, you know, mm-hmm. so we're creating more opportunities for resentment. We are not meeting our own personal needs. We're putting other people's needs ahead of ours. So now we're just totally sabotaging ourselves, thinking that this will be, you know, this will make other people like us. And again, that's choosing self-esteem over self-respect, in my view. And as I said, doing this internally is way more important.
So talk to me a bit about, you were saying other things you could do, dancing.
Yeah. So another, as I said, you know, the recipe is no different in our relationships with other people than it is for ourselves. So, you know, part of establishing a relationship with another person is this is level of physical vulnerability and intimacy. And I think dancing is a great way, again, to do that for yourself. You know, close the blinds, play your favorite song and just dance, you know, and get in attunement with your body, feel your body, see how your body moves, feel it. I think that's really important because movement in general is just medicine, you know,
mm-hmm.
great things happen when you move. Great things happen when you breathe deeper, when you exercise, just great things happen. And again, this is not a magic pill. This is just, you know, it just, everybody knows this from their own lives once they're more active. So I think, you know, dancing is a great way of doing that as well. You know, and then there's just other activities to be more physically, you know, intimate with yourself, whether it's self-havening and hugging yourself or, you know, another activity that I really promote is looking in the mirror naked and challenging yourself not to be critical and challenging yourself to be more grateful, recognizing that body in front of you has been with you since day zero and has mm-hmm. done everything in its power to be there for you, support you, work around our crappy diets, work around our bad postures, everything that we do, you know, whether we smoke cigarettes or consume a lot of alcohol, the body tries its best to work with us. And mm-hmm. just looking at it and saying thank you instead of looking at it with this critical eye, wishing it was better.
Well, and even in those moments, I think there can be power in noticing, can you say thank you to your body or do you go to the place of criticizing?
Yeah.
Even that exercise is an exercise in recognizing what you were talking about, which is when our ego steps in and basically tells us we're not worthy of appreciating ourselves.
1000%. And then also asking ourselves, you know, like, how are those ideas reinforced? Well, they're definitely reinforced when you go on social media. They're definitely reinforced whenever you go shopping, you know, and these are by design. You know, if everybody was happy with themselves, they wouldn't be contributing to the economy the way people are right now, trying to, you know, fill a void. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an important side to that. And that's why, you know, the subtitle of the book is Simple Truth for Going Easier on Yourself. Mm-hmm. Because as I said, like, this need to be liked, the need to be accepted, the need to, you know, be more than what we currently are, the need to feel like we have to be more perfect. I think a lot of this stuff is downloaded onto us. And these aren't things that we can just like flip a light switch and overcome. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think we can overcome insecurities or overcome this need for acceptance or overcome that critical eye when we look. But I think we can be more aware of it and be like, okay, my default, my reactionary state is to be critical, but now I'm going to be more responsive and I'm going to do the actual work and flip that into gratitude. And I think that just that level of self-awareness is going to be so liberating.
You have this quote in your book, we are flawed people raised by flawed people. Mm. Let's talk about that, because I think it's so profound to think about. We're human, and so we are flawed, but that doesn't make us unlovable.
Yeah. Yeah, perfection should not be a quantitative qualification for love. The example I use in the book is there's a video on YouTube of like a 4-minute compilation of Beyonce falling off stage and messing up.
Oh, right. You talked about this. Yeah.
And it's just a simple challenge of watch the video, see if you actually love her any less, if you're a fan. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it'll probably be the opposite. You'll see her vulnerable side and it'll make you love her even more, mm-hmm. you know? And I think when it goes to, you know, when we were, our understanding of those who raised us, which is often our parents, you know, we were young and our brains were developing. You know, I think the brain develops until like mid-20s. And so it's like.
And you know, we now know that there's even neuroplasticity beyond that, you know, with so much of the research that's happening right now.
That is, you know, and that's bananas. Think about how much of our personalities and our life choices and our direction are created so young and when we're still developing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, there's this idea of, I think a lot of people now are in this phase of recognizing past trauma or past influences and how that has shaped them. And then they kind of stop there. Like, well, I had a parent who was XYZ, so that's why I'm like this.
Yes.
And for me, it's like, no, we have to take it a step further. It's like, okay, cool. You've identified gaps in your upbringing because you were raised by imperfect individuals.
Right.
But now it's your responsibility to fill in those gaps.
Right.
Because you have self-pity in itself is this fast food version of self-love. You know, and it's very easy to view yourself as a victim, but there's no empowerment there.
Well, and show me someone who hasn't been raised by flawed people.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and the thing too is, and then anybody who's been, I think, yeah, they don't exist. And right. I think that's the thing, but there's this, I think there definitely is, as I said, it's very convenient or easy to just say, okay, well, now I can feel sorry for myself. Now I'm a victim of my circumstances. Mm-hmm. Not recognizing that without taking any accountability or responsibility. Taking responsibility is probably the better word. Take responsibility just for empowerment. If I'm driving in my car and somebody hits me from behind and it's 1000% not my fault, it's still going to be my responsibility to get the car repaired, to do all the insurance work, you know. It's not my fault, but it's still my responsibility.
Right.
It's not your fault that you were raised by people that weren't perfect. It's not your fault that you might have had an extremely shitty childhood, but it is your responsibility now to identify those gaps and do something. Yeah, fix the car.
Right.
Address the car. You can be your own nurturing parent now. I have a friend who grew up in the streets with a mother who had challenges with addiction. So he did not have a very traditional childhood. Mm-hmm. He has since, you know, made a really good life for himself. And, you know, he recently just told me I took my inner child to the dollar store and we went on a shopping spree. Mm. And I bought myself every toy I ever dreamed of when I was a kid. And he goes, it was $30 worth of, $30 worth of Cheetos, chocolate bars, and all this stuff. And, you know, I think, and he's like a very healthy and shaped individual, but it's like, he did this for his inner child. Mm-hmm. He's like, look, I know when you were a kid, you wanted this so bad. Here you go. Let's do it. You know, mm-hmm. and, you know, and walks out of the store with a bag full of candy and chocolate. And I'm sure, you know, he ate a bunch of it and I'm sure regretted it after because he's such a healthy eater.
Felt the effects.
Yeah, he probably felt the effects, but I love that idea because I think, and he was just also talking about how it started bringing up this kind of internal dialogue where his inner child was speaking to him about the way he walked and the way he moved and asked him all these questions about him as an adult. Like, why are we walking so fast? And then him being like, well, you know, where we grew up, you had to walk really fast and keep your head on a swivel and keep yourself safe. And well, I guess we don't have to do that anymore because we don't really live in a bad neighborhood anymore. So, you know, maybe I need to let go of some of these, you know, protective layers that I have. And I think that whole just buying candy was the catalyst for that kind of internal dialogue. And I think there's a beauty to that. Mm-hmm. So it's just recognizing that you have the capability to fill those gaps in now, you know, and again, buying yourself candy is a superficial kind of surface level, but there's also.
But what that allowed was for that opening and that conversation to happen, right? Like when we can attend to that child within us that feels, and again, I want to say, I don't think it matters if you had great parents. This is some of what Gabor Mate talks about in his work. It doesn't matter if you had the best parents in the world or the worst parent, the worst childhood in the world. At some point you experienced empathic failures.
Yeah.
Whatever those fail. He might have gotten fed Cheetos and candy and all of that. And then as an adult grown up and felt like, I can't believe all my parents did was feed me Cheetos and candy bars, right?
Yeah, there's that. I think there's also the fact that, you know, the younger you are, you know, you kind of have a center of universe mentality. So it's like, even if you experienced your parents, even if your parents weren't upset with you, but you've seen them upset, you might have internalized that. You know, my dad could have had a hard day at work, came home and been a grump. Mm-hmm. And 8-year-old me doesn't have context to understand that. He's not mad at me.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's me because I showed him my A and he just, you know, kind of disregarded it. And then I internalized that. And then you start creating a pattern that, oh, I have to earn his attention. I have to mm-hmm. earn his pride. I have to mm-hmm. earn. And then you start to think that's love. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then I might find myself only attracted to people who make me earn it because that's familiar. That's my, that's a nostalgia factor.
Right. And then you're unconscious in your life. And then when you become conscious, that's when you can correct those pathways, those patterns.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, and even for me, like, you know, even through this journey, I feel like I have become, I'm in between conscious and correct. Sorry, I'm in between the consciousness and the correction. So I've become much more conscious. And then, you know, maybe a lack of discipline or just by habit, I don't make the corrections. And then, you know, I get kicked in the teeth by life. But then there's we're not going to feel sorry for ourselves because we know why that happened. Like, you know, you identified your red flags in dating and you met this really pretty girl. You saw her red flags. You decided to disregard them. It all blew up in your face 2 weeks later. But take ownership. You know, you don't get to feel sorry for yourself because you knew it was going to happen.
Right.
And then in the back of my head, I'm like, we might do it again, but at least we're not going to feel sorry for ourselves. You know.
And maybe you're one step closer to not doing it again because you're like, there's those red flags and I'm going to listen this time. And I'm not going to beat myself up over being human.
Exactly. Exactly. Because I'm like, you know, a symmetrical face sometimes trumps a red flag and I'm learning the hard way that it shouldn't, you know, and
That damn ego.
It is that damn ego. And it's really hard. And then you start to see how I think the interesting thing that I've been learning, especially as a man who grew up in a culture that, again, it's all subtle signals, but thinking vulnerability was a weakness. And then, you know, building up all these layers of protection and a fortress. And then as an adult, starting to realize, oh, that fortress is a prison.
Mm-hmm.
And now, and then understanding the way this prison is designed, especially with everybody, is now everybody serves as a prisoner and a guard.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's, even if I'm trying to do better, I have to be mindful of the company I keep, because they may be reinforcing the old stuff. You know, they may make the comment to make me go back into my shell if I try to be vulnerable. They may, you know, validate if I show up to the party with a really pretty girl who's not, whose personality doesn't gel with mine.
Mm-hmm.
But they validate me like, whoa, why?
Right. How'd you do that? Right?
Yeah,
because then what does it mean
Whatever.
About you? It must mean a prescription about you.
Exactly.
Right? If you can.
Yeah. And then we're all in this social media generation now where everything, there's so much, you know, subtle rewards for doing things for display purposes. Just mm-hmm. looking happy seems to be more rewarding than being happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and as I said, if we're floating through life unconsciously and we all are on different degrees, you know. And again, like it's literally the smartest people in the world building these mechanisms to keep us trapped in. You
right,
know?
Right.
These companies have all the money, and they're going to hire all the best
son,
talent.
As my 13-year-old says, I'm not going to get stuck in the matrix.
And it's like, well, yeah, it's like, you might not be stuck in the matrix you're aware of. You know, there's just endless levels to it, and it's. As I remember, I was an elementary school teacher before all of this, and I thought the biggest cage I lived in was a day job. You know, I thought I wasn't free, and I feel like I hopped the fence and I got out and I became self-employed. And then maybe, you know, you run 6 feet and then you bump into another fence.
Right.
And then you start to realize like the biggest cages that I'm actually in are like the cages of my habits.
And my mind.
My mind.
Yeah.
They're all internal. It's not. You can unplug yourself from, you know, the external world in so many capacities, but the real issues is internal. And if you address it internally, then it doesn't matter if you have a day job. It doesn't matter if you're doing half the things that you're doing, being on your phone or whatever. And I think that's become a really interesting journey for me to kind of recognize. And as I said, like for me, it's, you know, if I had the ability to shove any religion down people's throats, it would be the religion of self-awareness. Just pick up on your patterns. Pay attention to yourself. Take intentional time to revisit and process things and realize that is your salvation in all of this. It's just know yourself. And also how to realize on that journey is still going to be limiting, because it is such a mind-blowing concept that the brain is even aware of itself.
Yes,
so, it is. Yeah. So like the most self-aware individual, you know, maybe that should be the new 10%. You know, there's that myth about we only use 10% of our brain.
Yeah.
Maybe the new framing should be the most self-aware person can only be aware of 10% of themselves. Maybe that might be a better way of putting it. Like we have endless blind spots, and it's potentially an entire universe in there. You know, there's probably an inwards infinity that we can't even grasp. And I think that we should just begin that journey and celebrate the progress.
Well, and then I think even beyond that is our connections to each other and how those connections reverberate within our minds. I'm going to take brains out of it. Minds are our consciousness, and how then that is impacting us in various ways that we also aren't even conscious and aware of. I mean, it's so, like you said, it's so multi.
Yeah, like we can literally just be drops in the ocean, and the membranes that make us feel like we're separate from the rest of the ocean is that ego.
Right.
And
completely.
Yeah, it's just about popping that membrane. And, you know, I feel like I've had those experiences, but, you know, only through the assistance of a medication or, you know, a DMT or something like that. And you get it for like. You get it for like 8 minutes, and then you're like, holy crap, I became everything and nothing.
Right. And then you spend the rest of your life trying to get back to that place again.
Yeah,
and you can feel it.
feel that, or just even spend the rest of your life now adjusting to this new level. Like, I think the amount of emotions that unlocked for me just moving forward for at least a solid 4 months before, mm-hmm. You know, I feel like it was, that journey was like the Kool-Aid man kicking down all my walls. I think mm-hmm. every other journey I'd ever taken, it was like I had to voluntarily surrender. And then that journey was like, nope, we're just going to kick it all down. Mm-hmm. All the walls are broken. You are now free from all of these things. And then, you know, life builds up a new wall, you know, then you go back to normal life and then new walls right. established. You know, and then you start to realize like, whoa, okay, well, 3 months ago, like, yeah, I couldn't get through Finding Nemo without just like my face leaking. And I couldn't, you know, have a conversation with anybody, or I couldn't make eye contact with a puppy without crying. It was so intense.
Right. Because you were feeling the depth of the connection that we yes. all have, that we all build around ourselves.
Yes, exactly. And it's, and again, as I said, it was a, you know, I think they refer to it as the handshake with God. You know, it was a slight preview of what existence could be beyond mm-hmm. what we understand. And it was like, yeah, you know, you spend the rest of your life trying to figure out how can I do that through meditation, or how mm-hmm. can I do that through different things. And, mm-hmm. and even, you know, going back to the list of things that we can do for self-love, my personal definition of meditation is doing nothing, you know, just being alone and doing absolutely nothing. And I think the reason I like that definition is so often when we sit down to meditate, there's a voice in our head saying, am I doing this right?
Right.
Am I doing this right? And I think if you tell yourself, well, the goal is to do nothing, mm-hmm. just sit there, do nothing. So there is no right or wrong. Like, we're taking right or wrong out of this equation. Just set a timer and now you're doing it. And maybe your mind might be saying, no, well, how much time's left? How much time's left? Which I still think is fine. And I kind of view that as like a natural way to kind of clear out the inbox to your brain. But I think it's also realizing, reestablishing a relationship with yourself where you can enjoy your own company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, loneliness isn't a circumstance. Loneliness is a feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, loneliness isn't being alone. Loneliness is not enjoying being alone. Because when you enjoy being alone, mm-hmm. then you have solitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and also you can feel lonely in a crowded room.
Totally. Yeah. You could feel yeah. lonely in a lot of relationships. And I think that yeah. goes back to the vulnerability piece. I think mm-hmm. when we aren't being vulnerable with ourselves or with others, it makes us feel more vulnerable, more alone. Because
yeah.
we feel like we're the only people experiencing what we're experiencing when everybody's experiencing what we're experiencing in different forms.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 1000%. I always use a heartbreak example where it's like everyone thinks their heartbreak is the first heartbreak on the planet,
mm-hmm.
and that requires them to ignore the million heartbreak songs that are already out. You know, somebody else has experienced this, they've processed this, they've written about it, they've created art around it. But you know, our first heartbreak feels like the worst thing in the world,
mm-hmm.
and it's oftentimes I think that's what the issue is. And and those are a lot of times the messages I get from people who read the books. It's like, I thought only I was going through this. And it's like, no, we're all in the same boat.
We just, right. And that's the drop of the ocean versus the ocean, right?
Yeah, exactly. We just think because the names are different, that makes our specific issue. It's like, no, like the details of the issue aren't as important as the feelings, the emotions, the thoughts and the experiences that come from it.
So before we wrap up for today, let's talk about love the verb versus love the noun.
Yeah. So, you know, as I said, when we talk about finding love, earning love, you know, I think a lot of that is this like love is some sort of prize. Love is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and there's no empowerment there because it does feel passive. You got to find it. You got to win it. You got to search for it. You got to deserve it. You got to be worthy of it. Whereas love the noun is service. You know, nobody can stop you from serving. Nobody can stop you from loving. Nobody, you know, you, the only way for you to stop loving others is if you forfeit that. You forfeit that. You know, your ability to love is probably the most valuable thing in your wallet. And focusing on love as an action, viewing it as service, and understanding that, I think very often the challenges are conflated or misguided understandings of love really have to do with the romantic element of it, because that's when we want reciprocity. You know, mm-hmm. that's when we want it to be we start viewing love as like a loan. You know, I lend it out, I get it back. But in every other relationship where we have love, we don't. You know, you have a child. You know, there's no reciprocity when the little baby, when you hold the little baby. You know, the little baby makes, you know, does something, you know, gives you a gift in the diaper. You know, like that's, you know, as my sister says, you know, she has a 17-year-old now. She goes, just every year, they just find different ways to poop on me. And she goes, and every year I just have to remind myself.
Being pooped on.
Yeah, they just, and they're pooping on you different ways as they get older. And right. Your job is going to always be the same thing, which is keep them alive.
Right.
You know, you don't just sit. She goes, my mantra is keep him alive, keep him alive, keep him alive. Right. And then maybe when he's 18, he'll figure out how to keep himself alive. But she's like, but
probably not.
But no, definitely not. And it's I think there's no questions about reciprocity. There's no questions about, you know, am I getting something back? There's no questions about have we established a relationship? None of these things matter. You know, I think with our family, with our siblings, with our friends, you know, we're not as concerned with reciprocity. Whereas a lot of the things when you first meet somebody, when you're trying to begin a romantic relationship, that's all you think about. Now you think about your presentation. You think about putting your best foot forward. You think about, you know, who pays the bill. You think about all of these different things. And I think that's where we're having this morbid view of love. And I think that's distortion. Whereas if we focus on love as service, we can love everybody, irrespective. And we can put ourselves in a healthier situation as a source of love where we'll be okay either way, whether we establish a relationship with somebody romantically or not, because we'll start to recognize a lot of the things that we often outsource, we can provide ourselves within. And I mean, look at the divorce rate in the United States. You know, I view that often as that's a result of people trying to outsource the antidote of their loneliness. You know, and I think,
and not look at themselves and love themselves and looking for that other person to fix inside of them what's wrong.
Completely. And I think it's also just super important to just recognize also, like, again, I don't think people are stupid for taking that journey, because I think also, as I said, we have an economy around it. You know, every single movie you watch will make you fall in love with the wedding more than the marriage.
Because they don't show the marriage a lot of times. And when they do, it's like those dark stories, right? Where like the marriage gets torn apart because a child dies or whatever it is. But that's the reality of the life of a relationship.
Exactly. And it's, as I said, and you start to also realize that, like, if you looked at the healthiest relationships that you know, you're like, oh yeah, these guys would not make for great TV. You know, there's not a lot of events. It's not a very eventful, you know, because love is peace.
Right.
You know, and you know, it's like, you know, it's like watching the fireplace channel. You know, it's just that channel.
Oh, I love that channel. I love that. Yeah. When you go into like a doctor's office and it's just the fireplace.
It's just the fire. And I feel like that's what watching a healthy relationship would be versus, you know, watching two people, you know, address conflict in a healthy manner, watching two people, you know, kind of not live for the high highs and the low lows, but kind of be even keel. But that's not going to be Ross and Rachel, you know, because Ross, for Ross and Rachel to be entertaining, it's got to be a cat and mouse game. It's literally, you need a, going to attachment styles, you need the avoidant and you need the anxious. You know, you can't have a secure person on screen because they're going to be boring. And I think,
and then, you know, this becomes the template for what people think relationships should look like, particularly if that's what they see in their lives too.
Exactly. And then also when you have, you know, I'm Punjabi, which is, you know, the northern part of India, you know, the wedding, you know, a Punjabi wedding, like, you know, your small Punjabi weddings are 500 people, you know, people are spending six figures to have these weddings. There's a booming wedding industry, you know, so, you know, and then everyone is pressured to get married at a certain age, you know, and then there's also the option of arranged marriages. So everything, you know, so if you want to have a stable job, you know, the wedding industry is as stable as the funeral industry. And it's just really important to see that, because you're selling an idea where, again, people are going into debt, getting married, and, you know, financial issues are a massive cause for divorce. You know, so you're cutting yourself at the ankles on day one. And right. and even from a cultural standpoint, what other moment in somebody's life do they celebrate the beginning of? You know, we don't throw a big party when we start high school. We don't throw a big party when we start college. We throw a big party when we finish or have an accomplishment. Wouldn't it make more sense to throw a big lavish party after 10 years of marriage versus after 0 years of marriage and celebrate that you've accomplished something?
Right. Yes.
Maybe spend six figures and, you know, have crystal centerpieces when on your 50th anniversary and be like, right. we actually really
did this marriage thing.
We did this marriage thing. And right. now we can also celebrate with people that we care about.
Right.
And our kids can be there and all of this stuff. And I feel like it's just recognizing that like there's an economy here and, you know, the people throwing your wedding are going to get paid regardless. The people officiating your wedding are getting paid regardless. The people doing the paperwork for your divorce are getting paid regardless. And it works out for everybody in that economy side of it. And I think that's something just to be mindful of. Because again, well, we grew up on the Disney films. We grew up on whatever. And these things, they lightly nudge us in these directions.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else is getting rich off of it.
And we're getting emotionally poor.
Yeah. Yeah. And financially poor for that matter. And I think, and I think that's just the thing where I start to realize like, oh, like a lot of, you know, I did Wim Hof. I met Wim Hof in 2020 and I went to Poland. Wim Hof is a Dutch breath work. Yeah. And we sit in the ice. So I got to train with him in Poland. And then I realized, okay, he's telling me to sit in ice and he's telling me to breathe intentionally. None of this requires me to buy anything. You know, maybe, you know, he's saying take cold showers. Or he's like, or at the most, let's go to the gas station, buy five bags of ice and put them in the tub. And I thought about that. I was like, this isn't like a complicated program. You know, that's why it's not as popular as, you know, maybe taking, you know, antidepressants or doing half the other things that we can, the pill forms of this stuff. And it's not even challenging. It's not even as hard as going to the gym to do his breath work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to realize, again, like the popularity of certain things, like if people did a lot of the things that actually make us well, like dancing in a room by yourself, going for a long walk, exercise.
Go meet a friend, sit across from them, look at them, talk to them.
Yes. Sit
from a friend. Look them in the eye.
Prioritize sunlight over your phone light, you know, the sunlight over blue light. Prioritize that. None of these things cost any money. And you start to realize that if the world actually did this, we our economy probably would crumble and it probably would be an uncomfortable time. So I understand how having an anxious population that needs coffee to start their day and Xanax to end their night, you know, keeps the wheels turning. And it allows for whatever we have. But I mean, as your son said, you know, we got to get out of this matrix. And I think if we pull out one at a time, it may not be such a catastrophic change.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Humble, thank you for this amazing conversation. I could just stay on here for a real long time. We could probably go a whole lot deeper. But I love this. If people are interested in finding you, you are lots of places. So tell them where they can find you.
Yep. So you can find me at Humble the Poet. I'm mainly on Instagram, but Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok. We just take the stuff from like YouTube and put it on TikTok. I try to avoid that app. That's a whole other conversation.
Oh my God. I know.
Yeah. And then you can just visit me at humblethepoet.com. And then the book is available everywhere books are available. So your Barnes & Noble, your Amazons, Indigo if you're in Canada, Waterstones if you're in the UK. And if you can't find it specifically, you can go to humblethepoet.com/love.
Thank you.
Like what you heard today and want to hear more? Wondering what comes next and what it all means? Head over to Apple Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts and hit subscribe. Also, if you could take a minute to rate and review my podcast, I would really appreciate it. Stay tuned as we continue to explore life, death, and the space between.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.